The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we're joined by historian and curator Hugh Ryan to learn about his new book, The Women's House of Detention, A Queer History of a Forgotten Prison. In the book, Ryan examines the history of our country's current crisis of incarcerating queer and transgender people through the story of the notorious mid-20th century Manhattan prison that held tens of thousands of women, transgender men, and gender nonconforming people. Writer Sarah Schulman, author of Let the Record Show, calls the book a truly radical, moral, and exciting history that will blow your mind. Hugh Ryan is the author of When Brooklyn Was Queer, an analysis of the famous borough's LGBTQ+ history from the 1850s to the present, which the New York Times described as boisterous, motley, entertaining, and insightful. The book won a New York City Book Award and was a New York Times Editor's Choice, as well as a finalist for the Randy Schiltz and Lambda Literary Awards. It also earned Ryan the 2020 Alan Berube Prize from the American Historical Association. This evening, the author will be in conversation with Saida Rashid, Director of the Center for Gender Resources and Sexual Education at Haverford College. It's a pleasure to have them with us tonight. Please welcome Hugh Ryan and Saida Rashid to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thanks, y'all, for coming out on what is an unexpectedly beautiful night. I was promised thunderstorms and misery. What gives?
These microphones are more intimidating.
I know.
So thank you for joining us. First of all, happy Pride Month to everyone.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. We're very excited to hear about you and the stories that you shared through your writing. So the first question, so within the first pages of the book, you write, "To look at prisons historically is to see a monstrously efficient system doing exactly what it was designed to do, hide every social problem we refuse to deal with. The initial design of the Women's House of Detention proposed what was considered a reform concept, right? Which existed of the prisons back then is an add more with medical equipment, massive hospitals, and extensive psychological services. But instead, it became this 12-story maximum security prison in the heart of the Greenwich Village, and imprisoning hundreds of folks, many of whom were queer, non-binary, gender-conforming, transmasculine folks, and hiding almost every form of violence when it comes to gender, sexuality, race, class, mental health, you name it. So will you share with us about how the House of D actually functioned over the years, as well as the role that it played in the Greenwich Village, making it a profound queer cultural landmark?
Absolutely, a great place to start. It's interesting. The Women's House of Detention is not a building I knew anything about for many, many years. I am from a New York family. My family's from the Bronx. I was a women's studies major. I was a queer journalist living in the city. I was doing curating shows on queer history. And I still didn't know anything about the prison and about the history, the long and disturbing history of the women's legal system in our country. So when I started doing this research, my previous book, When Brooklyn Was Queer, kind of led me there. I was following some folks whose lives led through the prison. And I started with the most recent time period. And what I saw right away was that I didn't understand what was happening. Like, on a very basic level, everything that occurred in and around the prison seemed to not match up with what it was that I thought prisons were supposed to do in this country. I thought prisons were broken, right? That they were about justice and rehabilitation, and they just weren't doing it right somehow. And that when I dug into this history, I would come to understand why. But that actually is not what happened at all. The further I dug, the further I went back through liberal times and conservative ones, I saw prisons functioning the exact same way. They served as drains and stopgaps for every system that actually was broken, right? The prison, particularly the Women's House of Detention and women's prisons in America, but all prisons really aren't about crime and justice. They are about dealing with particularly working class people, but large groups of people that are society does not want to provide for and needs to put somewhere. So as I started digging into this prison, I just kind of kept going further and further back. Mm-hmm. The Women's House of Detention opened in 1932, and they started building it in 1929. But to actually understand what it was and what it was doing, I had to go all the way back to 1870, which is a kind of random-sounding year, but it's actually the year in which a big prison reform conference was held in Ohio to kind of design the future of prisons in America. The Civil War had just happened. We were living in a very Victorian society, but because of the Civil War, more and more women were entering the public sphere. Black women who had been formerly enslaved, and white women who had taken on new jobs and other sort of public careers because of the war. The first census after the Civil War is the first time America asks about women's employment, right? Women are entering the public sphere. So they've got this big prison reform conference to figure out how do we deal with this. Because it's a Victorian time. Women are so different from men that the same institutions can't serve them, nor can the same people. Women need female professionals in order to understand how to help them. So you're asking about reform, right? This is a reform movement from the very beginning. Their idea is that they are going to help women who have been incarcerated or are in danger of being incarcerated. But their idea of how to help someone, and in general, the carceral system's idea of how we help, is all about incarcerating, right? The carceral system is a blunt force instrument. It sees only one solution to every problem. And so what they start to develop in the 1870s in this conference is that we have this system that exists for punishing the violent antisocial acts of white men, right, who are arrested for crimes against people like assault and crimes against property like arson. As women and black people enter into this public world, into this criminal legal sphere, no longer controlled by the family but by the legal system, they start to repurpose this system to, quote-unquote, help women. And their idea of helping women went like this. There are only two legitimate jobs that a woman can have. She can be a wife or she can be a maid. And if she is not capable of performing either of those functions, she will end up an economic burden on the state and a prostitute, because that's the third job that is among the three jobs women can have. So the prison system, in order to prevent poor women from becoming prostitutes, decides that what they need to do is focus on gender conformity, right? The sign that a woman is going to end up on the streets is that she is not qualified to be a maid or a wife. She is not feminine enough. And so they construct an entire legal apparatus that is about arresting women for a different kind of crime. Not crimes against property, not crimes against people, but crimes against the public order. Things like drunkenness, waywardism, running away from home, being truant, wearing pants, being alone on the street at night. All of these things become arrestable offenses when committed by women or people assigned female at birth. And it starts with this reform conference in the 1870s. By the time the House of D rolls around in 1932, all of this is enshrined in law. In New York State, there is a case called People X Rel Miller versus Brockman, which says that there needs to be no evidence of the exchange of sex for money for a woman to be arrested as a prostitute. Rather, prostitution is simply the common lewdness of a woman. Any woman who was seen as poor was the same as a prostitute. And so thousands of these women are getting arrested all around New York City and incarcerated and brought to Greenwich Village, where the House of D was, right at the moment when Greenwich Village starts to get a reputation as being this queer space, right? This all goes back in the village to 1910, when the Women's Court was started, the women's court, although it sounds like a court for all women, is really just a court for people arrested for prostitution and public drunkenness. Because that's what womanhood is, right? You have to incarcerate people for a different kind of crime, so you need an entire different kind of court. And the court, when it was set up, understood that its primary function was not to help these people, but rather, as the chief probation officer wrote in her memoir, it was to show proper women the lives of those who had succumbed to shame. So this court, this women's court, is built like a theater. The seats rake so that everyone has a good view. They made flyers advertising that people should come to watch these arrested women so that they would learn how to behave. This starts in 1910. By 1917, there are multiple newspaper articles every year about how uptown slumming rich folks come to watch arrested women. This is the start of what will eventually become cafe culture in Greenwich Village. These women are what make the village a tourist destination, in the same way that working class Black people made Harlem a tourist destination. This is about providing entertainment for rich white people in the forms of queer women being arrested. And those women and trans masculine people go on to transform the village. In all of for the 1920s, this sociologist named Carolyn Ware studied Greenwich Village to understand what was happening there. And she calls out the fact that unlike any other neighborhood in the city, the village had public institutions, bars, for queer women in the 1920s. It's not a coincidence. The prison was bringing queer women from all around the city to Greenwich Village every year. And as homophobia grew in America, particularly post-World War II, when we get into that really awful conservative kind of 1950s moment, the village becomes unique because the police can raid the bars, right? They can arrest you in your home and they can beat you in the street. But they are the ones bringing the women to Greenwich Village. They are the ones bringing them to the prison. And so the prison cannot be controlled the same way every other space for queer people can be. And for that reason, Greenwich Village gets so much of the reputation that it has. So we have this long history of a women's incarceration system that focuses on gender nonconformity. And then that system plants its flag in Greenwich Village, which becomes the queerest neighborhood in America until, you know, San Francisco kind of edges this out a little. So it's all intertwined together in a way that I truly knew nothing about, because so much of this history, as all of the women who I was able to speak to who have been incarcerated in the House of D said to me, has been erased, forgotten, and purposely destroyed.
Wow. Thank
you. I should say I go on really long in answer to any question. So if at any point you or someone else in the audience is like, can you go back to what she actually asked? Like, please do say so.
No, that's good. So the second question is about the role of social workers. And as a social worker myself, like, I was really drawn into like their notes, the lens, and everything. And one of the main source information that informed your research was files kept by social workers of Women Prison Association, which was an organization that was run predominantly by upper and middle class white social feminists. And we all know that there's a complicated history of social work in this country. So what was the role the social workers played when it comes to providing these progressive services and documenting cases that we're looking at right now, that you are looking at right now, while also gatekeeping and making a value-based judgment of who is deserving and who isn't deserving of their services?
No, social workers have a very deep role to play in all of this. It's very complicated, as you said. On an individual level, they imagine themselves to help people, and often on an individual level they did, but they were in a much bigger system that was focused on penalizing the very women they were trying to help, right? So the system they are part of is penalizing the people they are trying to help. And the women inside this system, from the social work point of view, are all over the political spectrum. Some of them are much more progressive than others, particularly on queer information, but some of them are very conservative. The way that I ended up looking at these records, I was trying to figure out, how do I tell this story from the point of view of the folks who have been incarcerated? Because the prison system gives you data, right? Fungible numbers. This many arrested, so many convicted, this many years. But they don't actually tell you anything about the lives of these people. And I knew that I couldn't tell this story from the point of view of the criminal legal system, because it would be boring and wrong. and very biased. So I began to imagine the lives of the folks that I wanted to write about and think about how they would enter into the public record, because you only get into public records in two ways, right? Either you have power, and therefore you can preserve your own records, you can have a house and your stuff gets preserved and passed down to your descendants, newspapers interview you, yada, yada, yada. Or, on the other hand, someone else has power over you, and you enter the record through them, through the information they want to preserve. You are the raw material for their entry into the public record. That's how most of these incarcerated folks end up in the public record, through the jails. But I had to think about places where they would have power over them, but by people who were concerned about their lives and the questions that I had, which is how I hit on social workers, right? Because social work was seen as a necessary link for helping these women who had been incarcerated to avoid becoming prostitutes or queer people. So they'd be asking about the right questions. And the Women's Prison Association was the oldest organization in the country working with formerly incarcerated women. They were around since the mid-1800s, and these records that they kept are absolutely invaluable. For the earliest part of the prison's period in the 1930s, New York City actually did not fund social workers or psychologists for the prison system. Instead, those positions were funded by the Women's Prison Association themselves. And because of that, unlike all the other social work organizations, which also kept records, they were very closely imbricated with the Women's House of Detention. The head of social work in the House of D was a woman who had worked for the Women's Prison Association, and she made sure that their records were connected, as were their services, because one of the very first things they point out is that what happens when you are incarcerated is that the moment you leave the prison, all services for you are dropped. And you are expected to figure out how to get new services, how to get a new place to live, how to get a job, within days of emerging from a place that trained you for none of that, connected you to no one, and disconnected you from everything you had known before. So the Women's Prison Association really saw it as their role to try and help these formerly incarcerated women. But unfortunately, there was very little that they could do to change the system. Help often meant doing an absolute minimum to try to keep these women alive, right? To make sure they were fed and housed. But even that housing came with its own level of social control. You could stay in their residence if you agreed to all their rules, which included things like never wearing pants, which women could also not do in the prisons. Or they could try to connect you with public housing, but public housing had all of these rules around never having been incarcerated or you could be kicked out, owning enough furniture or you could be kicked out, not being considered a nuisance, never having been sent to a mental institution, which many queer people unfortunately are. So again, all the systems they had to connect people to were just as punitive as the system they had come out of. So social workers were often caught in this position where even the most progressive and liberal of them would rail against the system they were in, but there was very little they could do to oppose that system. This was the only place they had to do this work. So one of the women that I follow in the book, minorly, is named Barbara Manley Phillips. She was an incredible Quaker progressive reformer from the 1920s all the way up through the 1970s. And she really did work with individual queer people very closely. As early as 1934, in her files, I can see her telling women, there is nothing wrong with who you love. There is nothing wrong with you. If you are happy as you are, you should continue that way. But most of the women who are working as social workers are not like her. And even she could do very little to help the people she wanted to help.
Thank you. As a follow-up, can you speak a little bit more about the folks of color and black women and how were they served and like not served by the social workers?
Yeah. So that's actually really interesting. So one thing that you have to understand sort of race and prisons in New York City is that over the course of the 20th century, New York goes from having a 98% white population to a 44% white population. Anti-urban white flight, the Great Migration, the influx of folks from Puerto Rico because of American colonial capitalism, they all formatively change our city over the very decades where the House of D was active. So in the earliest years, it is almost all white women who are in the House of Detention. over the course, the later end of the Great Depression, this starts to switch, but we don't know exactly when because it was the Great Depression, and New York City had no money for keeping records. So neither the court system nor the prison system put out an annual report for the entirety of the 1930s. So we know where the prison system was at about 1932, and in 1941, when they put out new records, everything has shifted. Suddenly, about 60% of the women in the prison are black. And that is a major change from 1932, when it was about 80% were white. That change doesn't happen for men until the late 1960s. So it happens much earlier for women, because again, women are being arrested for different things. And those things are largely connected to being in the public sphere. And black women, way more than white women, had to work. They had to be out on the streets. They had to be in places where the police could get them. And that's what makes a big change. For the social workers now, this presented a different set of issues. They believed that they should help both black and white women at the Women's Prison Association. However, again, a lot of that help was about connecting them to other organizations. And these white women simply did not know anything about the black community, did not have connections in it, did not do the research to provide the resources they needed. So in those moments, when they did try to help black women, they often were unable to because of their own ignorance. They would write things in their notes like, "We suggested that maybe some members of the colored population could help." You know, like as though that's an actual useful thing to tell a woman who has just gotten out of prison. Maybe you can find someone to help you. They did help some black women. And I find them from the records in the 1930s all the way up until the very end of the time when the prison closed. But in general, to get the help of social workers, they had to believe you were redeemable. And again, when it comes to the prison system, that means properly feminine. And traditionally, historically, and today, black women are always judged to be more masculine, more aggressive, more violent, and less feminine than their white counterparts. So over and over again, simply the fact of being black made these social workers assume that there was no point in working with black women. Either they could not get them to services, so why even try, or they would not be appropriate for those services because they were too masculine.
Thank you. So we often talk about how the first Pride was actually a riot, referring to the Stonewall Uprising. So what was actually happening at the House of Dee during the night of uprising?
Okay, this is one of my favorite parts of the book, and one that really surprised me. Like, again, over and over again, a lot of this book was really me being super ignorant and then finding out things I didn't know. Night of the Stonewall Riots, the first night of the Stonewall Riots, a number of people, women, talk about how when they first found out the riot was happening, it was because, there's a woman named Arcus Flynn. She was interviewed as part of the Daughters of Bilitis, right? An early lesbian organization. And she says she was driving home that night from her job as a nurse. And she was driving through the West Village. And she looked up through the windshield of her car. And she noticed these little points of light flying through the sky. And she pulled over because she couldn't figure out what was going on. And when she did, she realized they were fires. And that women in the prison were setting fire to their belongings and throwing them out the windows while chanting, "Gay rights, gay rights, gay rights." And she followed those beacons to the Stonewall Inn because the prison was 500 feet away from Stonewall. They could see what was happening. They could smell what was happening. The women knew about the riot and held a riot all their own, which is traditionally left out of the story of Stonewall, right? We don't hear about these women and what they did. They were rioting in that prison throughout the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s. Rarely is this ever talked about. But there are two really important points to this story that really show that at the time, everyone understood that the prison and the bar were linked symbolically. Stonewall and the House of Dee were one riot. And those two things are this. First, in Stonewall, in the bar that night, or in the prison that night, we don't have a lot of records of who was involved with this riot. But we do know there were two queer black women who were leaders in the community who were incarcerated there that night, Afeni Shakur and Joan Byrd. Both were leaders in the Black Panther Party. Both were young. Both had been arrested as part of this giant police conspiracy to break the Black Panther Party. They were in the prison on the night of Stonewall. And in fact, Joan Byrd was there for a year and a half while she was on trial, a trial for which Afeni Shakur, the mother of Tupac, the rapper, stood as her own lawyer and was the reason that these people got off. She was such an excellent and incredible lawyer. After the trial, after the Panther 21 are found innocent, she would work with Huey P. Newton to connect the Black Panther Party with the emerging gay rights movement. She went to the constitutional convention that the Black Panther Party held, and she met with the Gay Men's Workshop, where she told them, being in the prison and seeing the banners of queer people protesting outside made her think about gay liberation and Black liberation, and made her think about the struggles and the way they were interconnected. She didn't mention the fact that she had also met her girlfriend, Carol Crooks, while she was in the prison, but I was able to talk to Carol a couple of times. She passed away, unfortunately, during the COVID-19 pandemic, as did every single woman except for one who I spoke to who was incarcerated in the House of D. Every single one except for one died during the COVID pandemic. But Carol told me that Afeni knew once she got out that these struggles had to be connected, and she was trying to draw them together, and she would do almost anything to make that work. At one point, she invited the Gay Liberation Front to a meeting with Huey P. Newton in Jane Fonda's apartment, which was apparently like a very freewheeling and crazy situation. There's footage of that on YouTube that you can find. I can tell you how to find it later. But so all of this is happening from the Black Panther point of view, right? Afeni Shakur is working from the Black Panthers to connect with gay liberation at the exact same time. So Stonewall happens. The protest happens. The women in the Black Panthers, Afeni Shakur gets out. But the leaders of the gay movement who are in Greenwich Village really want to harness this energy of Stonewall. The folks who were older leaders, the Mattachine Society, the Daughters of Bilitis, they held a community meeting about 2 weeks after the initial Stonewall riot, and they wanted to ask what we should do next. And the younger activists, the folks who had been at Stonewall, like Martha Shelley and Jim Farratt, said, we want to protest the Women's House of Detention in support of the Black Panther Party. And the older activists said no. They would not do it. They wanted to do something the police approved of. Because the other part of the Stonewall riot that rarely gets talked about is that Seymour Pine, the officer who actually led the charge into Stonewall, was an anti-vice cop who was actually trying to break the grip of the mob on bars in New York. And he saw gay bars as the sort of thin wedge in which to do it. So the older homophile organizations actually thought they could work with Seymour Pine and with the police, and they didn't want to do anything to piss him off. When the younger activists heard this at this meeting, they immediately stormed out, and they announced that they were going to form a new organization, which is how the Gay Liberation Front, one of the most important gay activist groups in the 1970s, was created. And their first protest was outside the Women's House of Detention on August 4th, and they continued to protest the prison over and over and over again. They spent an entire week outside of the prison from Christmas to New Year's at the end of 1969 in a permanent encampment with the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, the Radical Lesbians. They were there during the Women's Day riot in May of 1970. They were there in August of 1970 when the police raided another gay bar called Haven. And they had been organizing this big protest against police brutality in Times Square. So the Gay Liberation Front comes marching down to Sheridan Square, to what they called, you know, the birthplace of gay rights in honor of Stonewall. And they run smack dab into the exact same thing happening again at the Haven. And it formed another multi-day anti-police riot in Greenwich Village that's almost never talked about anymore, called the Haven Riot. All of this was happening around the House of D. The House of D was the place where Black Panthers, Gay Liberation, the Young Lords, the Radical Lesbians, the Youth Against War and Fascism all came together. Because at the time, they understood that these struggles were interlinked and that what happened at Stonewall was as much about the prison as it was about the bar.
Wow. Thank you. So I have a couple more questions. One is, you mentioned at the end of the book that for every story that you said, that you told, there's 50 that you didn't tell, right? So looking back at the stories that you chose in the books, are there any stories that you wish you would have like said more about or had more time to research and follow up?
There are so many. The truth is, so the way that I do my research generally for everything that I work on is that I'll spend years swimming in kind of the research. I spent 4 years looking at the records and interviewing people before I ever set kind of a word down on paper to write, because I need to see the patterns, right? I need to understand what is happening to them so that I can make a timeline and sort of say, like, okay, arrests for drug use start to appear here. Why? Women start complaining about endemic overdrugging in the prison with Thorazine here. Why? All of these kinds of things. So then, once I've sort of established my timeline, I go back into my research to say, which person can sort of walk us through this in the best sense, you know, because I've seen 90 people, let's say now, who are arrested because they accepted a ride from a guy who turned out to be an undercover cop. Which is the one person whose story best captures that? Because when you read history, if you don't read it as an embodied and fleshed sensory emotional thing, you don't remember it, and you certainly don't care about it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I read a lot of textbooks when I was in high school, and I remember nothing, like almost nothing. I also have a terrible memory, which is really sad as a historian. But I knew that I needed these things to feel, to make people care about them. So there are tons of women that unfortunately did not get into the book because I only had so much room. There are some that I tried to like name check a little bit. There's a woman that I mentioned early on named Alice. I only tell a tiny bit of her story because there were just too many other people who had very similar stories. But she has this incredible life where she's like 6'2" in 1937, and she's like this powerful woman whose only friend is the reclusive multimillionaire who lives in her small Maine town and lends her books. And she comes to New York because she falls in love with this opera diva. And then the opera diva is incredibly cruel to her and marries this man and makes her watch them have sex. At which point Alice has a mental break and she disappears. She's found 3 days later by the police wandering the streets of New York City with no idea who she is. So of course they arrest her as a prostitute because that's what you do with poor women. And she's then incarcerated. She gets out. She establishes a really close relationship with the Women's Prison Association. She gets back on her feet, but she can't get a job because now she's been incarcerated. And women were the first people, women arrested for prostitution, upon which fingerprinting was pioneered in America, right? They realized that they didn't have a good way of tracking arrested people, particularly women. So there was this new idea from France called fingerprinting, and they wanted to try it out here, the New York City police. So they tried it out on prostitutes because there were a lot of them. No one cared what happened to them. If it turned out that fingerprinting did not work for identifying, well, then the results didn't matter all that much. And what it did was it put arrested women at a unique disadvantage. Men could give a new name, men could disappear and move on, but women could not. And as the administrative state grows in America, those fingerprint records become more and more dangerous because more and more kind of jobs will keep you out if you have an arrest record. So by the time Alice has a record, you can't get a job as a nurse or in a hospital or in a bar or in a theater, if you have in a bank, in an airline, if you have an arrest record. So she can't get a job anywhere. She finally ends up working as a public safety monitor at a children's playground in the Lower East Side, where a drunk man comes along and tries to abduct one of the children, and she kills him. And she, that time, manages to get off. She doesn't get sent to jail. But after that, she just can't stay in the city anymore, and she leaves. And as far as I can tell, it seems like she went back to her small town, went back into the closet, and died a spinster aunt many, many decades later. Stories like this were so common. There were so many women in every decade. In the 50s, there were these two sisters who I came across, one in the Women's House of Detention, one in an institution somewhere further upstate, both arrested for being lesbians. Basically, there's no other reason for it. And they are in touch. They are trying to, the one who is in the House of D is trying to get in touch with one who seems to be in maybe a mental institution. She's not exactly sure. But they're never able to really get in touch. And the files don't tell me very much because they are such out lesbians in the 1950s and nobody wants to work with them. And so the file is really short. So there wasn't much I could do with that. They were both from Puerto Rico, both teenage lesbians in New York in the 1950s. It's a fascinating moment, but there was so little that I could find out about them. So there are tons of these files. And this set of data that I used for the earliest years, the Women's Prison Association files, there are 140 boxes of those files. Each box contains about 100 case files. So we're talking thousands of case files. I got through a lot of them. but not all of them. There is so much more to be found in these records. And one of the things that I'm actually supremely happy about is that the New York Public Library emailed me last week to say that there has been an incredible uptick in researchers looking at those records in particular since the book came out. I think that we are about to see a real boom in scholarship because what these people in the Prison Association preserved is simply unrivaled in terms of queer archives.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah. So my last question is about the work that you have done about 10 years ago. You founded the Pop-Up Museum of Queer History, a community-based history exhibits that were across the country. As one of your pop-ups, you actually came to Philly and worked with the William Way LGBT Community Center in 2012 for the Pop-Up Philadelphia. So can you talk about the origin story of the Pop-Up Museum of Queer History, as well as what do you remember most about the Philadelphia exhibit?
I always say that the Philadelphia exhibit was the best exhibit that the Pop-Up Museum did. I have such fond thoughts about it. So the Pop-Up Museum, in 2010, I had just gotten my degree, an MFA in nonfiction, and I thought that I was going to write funny personal essays a la David Sedaris, but I realized that I actually hated writing about myself, and that that was a real problem. So I stopped. And instead, I turned to curating. I was doing shows, and there was this big exhibit at the Smithsonian called Hide Seek, Difference and Desire in American Portraiture. It was the first ever queer exhibit in the Smithsonian. And 2 months into its existence, there was a protest from a Christian right group that wanted a number of artworks pulled, including a piece called A Fire in My Belly by the artist David Warnerovich. David Warnerovich was my favorite artist. When the piece was, in fact, pulled by the Smithsonian, 24 hours later, without ever talking to the curators of the show, they just completely folded. There were protests around the country, and I got involved in those. And then I had this weird moment. I was at a protest in New York City about this one piece of art at a show in the Smithsonian that I was probably never going to see. And I realized that there were no queer history shows at any major museums in New York City that I could remember ever going to. And why was I spending all my time protesting the goddamn Smithsonian when there was so much I could be protesting here? And then I thought, okay, wait. Maybe there's something more productive that I can do. I spent a lot of time protesting, but I'm angry all the time, and it's not healthy. And so I decided, what would I do as a museum? What would it mean for queer people to have our own museum, to have queer space, queer exhibit makers, a queer audience, to not worry that we could be pulled for being too offensive, or that there wouldn't be a bathroom that we could use, or that we could be attacked by the Christian right and have the whole institution fold underneath us? And so I called it the Pop-Up Museum of Queer History. I didn't know what it was going to be. That's what I told everyone. I said, everyone can make an exhibit. We don't know what this is going to be. This is a thought experiment. We're going to host it in my apartment, and we'll just see what happens. And on the first night, 300 people showed up, including 14 plainclothes cops who came to shut us down because we violated fire code. At midnight, as we were in the middle of a performance art piece in which a woman had made life-size felt cutouts of 1960s police officers and given us all high-heeled shoes and handbags to throw at them while screaming the names of our femme ancestors. You can imagine how well the cops took that. But once we were shut down, it was like this incredible origin story. Everyone was like, okay, when's the next one? We're so excited. When's the next show? And I was like, I have not planned. This was like a one-night only institution. But there was so much interest that a group of us gathered together and we started to imagine, for real, what would this be? What would a pop-up museum of queer history do? What would it look like? And why would it exist? And very quickly, we hit upon this idea that what we really wanted to do was work with local communities to bring out the histories of the places where they were, to bring the resources that we had in New York to bear in places that might not have the amount of money that we had or the connections to archives like the New York Public Library. So we started working in New York and then around the country. With each show, we kind of built what we were doing a little bit more. So by the time we came to Philly, we had a really robust idea. We would partner with a local community organization that would give us kind of guidance to what the community wanted and help us to do some initial focus groups and talk about what we want from a pop-up museum for this place. So here in Philly, that was the William Way Center. They also gave us space to do the exhibit in. Together, we would raise the money. The pop-up museum itself would raise a third of the money. The host organization would raise a third of the money. And together, the community would raise a third of the money. So that way, it was everyone's museum, right? No one had the control. And if there wasn't any interest, then we would never raise the funds, and it wouldn't happen. We put out a call for proposals. And in Philly, we got an incredible response. There were so many people who wanted to share Philly's local queer history. Even up to the day the exhibit opened, we had people showing up and saying things like, I remember this, the morning the exhibit was set to open, this guy showed up and said, Joseph Beam, the writer, was a good friend of mine. I have his writing desk and copies of all of his books. Can I bring it? Can we install it here? And so we did, as a little writing nook where people could sit and read his books and other books by queer Philadelphians and write love notes to them and hide them in the desk so other people could find them. A lot of the exhibits were very interactive like that, which is what I really love. It brings it to life. Because we, again, wanted this history to mean something, to feel like something. There was also a guy named Rich Wilson who lived in Philadelphia at the time, but is now in Chicago, because I just saw him at my reading in Chicago 2 days ago. I haven't seen him since I was here in Philly. And he is an incredible community archivist. For decades, he has been buying queer ephemera in places like eBay and estate sales, places where it has been abandoned, and preserving it in thousands of tiny little Ziploc bags that he keeps safe in his closet. And he brought out this collection of postcards from the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, all of these queer postcards from around the world. I mean, they were magical, things you would never expect to see, drag kings and drag queens in Paris in 1910. They were just these touches of our shared history that are magical to see. And the Philly show had the best attendance that we had. It lasted for a full month. We always point to it as our most successful pop-up museum show ever. And interestingly enough, after the Philly show, we felt so good about what we were doing that we're like, we're going to return to Brooklyn, and this time we're going to do it right. We're going to do a show about Brooklyn's history. Because that first one that we did was just queer history generally. We didn't know yet what we were doing. So we come back to Brooklyn, 2013, we're super excited, we put out a call for proposals, local queer Brooklyn history, and we get silence. Because it turns out that in Brooklyn, not very many people knew their own queer history for a lot of different reasons. Partly because of the relationship between Brooklyn and Manhattan, right? Because Manhattan is such a center, it kind of pulls the gravity towards it. But also what I would come to learn is that part of the reason is that Robert Moses, the sort of power broker of New York City who changed a lot of the architecture, was responsible for a lot of the urban renewal of the 20th century, destroyed most of Brooklyn's queer communities. Not on purpose. He was really just, he hated working class people, but he happened to destroy all of the queer communities. But when I got no response from this initial pop-up museum idea for Pop-Up Brooklyn, I started to ask myself why I didn't know any of that history and why I had never learned any of that history, even after doing these museums now for years and living in Brooklyn for years. And that's when I started to research the queer history of Brooklyn. And the New York Public Library gave me a grant to do it. And they said to me, when you are at the end of this grant period, you should have your book proposal together. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head. I was like, oh my God, I'm writing a book. Finally, my grad degree will mean something. So we did the exhibit at the Brooklyn Historical Society, and it took a number of years to get it together to find all the resources. I spent the 5 years that it took to put that together actually writing that book, and we did the book launch and the opening of the exhibit on the same weekend, which was also the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot. So it was this kind of tremendous coming together moment, all thanks, I say, to Pop-Up Philly.
I love it. There's a beautiful, like a 5-minute video tour of the queer Brooklyn landmarks that you mentioned in the books too, which is also fun.
New York Magazine took me on a fun little tour. They were like, take us on a tour of Brooklyn's queer history. And I was like, unfortunately, thanks to Robert Moses, it's mostly a tour of on-ramps and parking lots. But there are a few buildings that are still there. And so they took me around and we did like a little 5-minute tour of a brothel that was called the biggest scandal to ever hit the Senate during World War II, the swastika swishery, as the papers called it. We went to Coney Island and talked about drag kings and drag queens and bearded ladies. We went to downtown Brooklyn and talked about all the cruising pleasures of the subway stations and Hart Crane writing about poems about the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a fun little video. You can find it if you look Hugh Ryan in New York Magazine, somewhere on YouTube.
Somewhere on the YouTube. So that's pretty much it for all the questions that I had. And so I would love to have open up the space for anyone in the audience to ask any questions.
Yeah, and please ask any questions about what I talked about, what I didn't talk about. I'm unoffendable. So please, anything you want to talk about, go for it.
Thank you very much for your research. It's been eye-opening. And this is more a comment rather than a question. out of the research that you had done for the Women's House of Detention, formerly incarcerated women are coming out of prison today having those same exact barriers. And it struck me that that things have not gotten any better, or at least not much better. And so that's, like I said, it's not a question, but just a comment that I was struck by.
Absolutely. I mean, you're so right. That is exactly what I was struck by doing this research. I really thought that there would be some way to reform this system. But when you look at it historically, you just see that that is a joke, that reformation is not possible. The abolitionist Mariam Kaba, who's like one of my favorite writers in the whole world, if you haven't read her book, We Do This Till We Free Us, just absolutely brilliant. Go pick it up today. Don't buy mine, buy hers. It's so good. But she says in it, cages confine people, not the conditions that facilitated their harms or the mentalities that perpetuate injustice, right? Because this system isn't about justice. And that is what I saw, like you said, looking at this. It continues. The same issues have plagued this system from day one. One of the first protests against the Women's House of Detention is about the invasive, disgusting, brutal pap smears and physical exams that they gave every single person who passed in and out of the prison. They were protesting that in 1934. When the Daily News writes about those protests in 1934, they dryly noted that the mayor had announced that that should not happen a year before, and no one had ever done anything. For the entire time the prison system is open, the heads of the prison and the head of the Department of Corrections for New York City say that those pap smears and searches have produced no evidence of contraband ever, ever, but they continue doing it. Still to this day, this is happening in Rikers Island. The New York City has been sued and lost multiple times in just the last decade after these brutal physicals, and yet nothing changes, right? Nothing changes. That's why I stopped being a reformer and moved entirely into the abolition camp, because reform only works if it has a goal to get us towards decarcerating this country. Otherwise, the reforms do very little. And what they do only lasts for as long as people pay attention. The second people turn their heads away, the system relapses right back to cruelty. Only now it's usually bigger than it was before, because that is the reform we often get. More square footage, more guards, longer sentences, more money, more cages. That's it. I really bring the energy down. Sorry.
I should read the book, but why was the prison ultimately closed, assuming it was?
Yeah, okay, so great question. Right back to those invasive searches that I was talking about. 1965, women have been protesting these searches for 33 years. Nobody listens, nobody cares. But 1965, an 18-year-old woman who is a peace protester from Bennington College was arrested outside the UN. Every Friday, this collegiate network of police protesters would protest the Vietnam War on the steps of the UN Plaza. Every Friday they were arrested. This particular Friday, however, the police didn't show up, and they didn't show up, and they didn't show up. And so finally, a couple of folks decided they were going to leave the protest, and they offered to carry some belongings for folks who were staying behind. This will become important a little later on in the story. So this 19-year-old girl gives this other woman some of her clothes. Those women leave. The police descend. This 19-year-old girl and two other women are arrested. They are sent to the Women's House of Detention. They are brutalized on the way in so badly that this girl was scarred internally, bruised internally, and severely hurt. The prison did nothing. They wouldn't even let them contact their lawyers. They were in there for 3 days before they were able to reach anyone. During that time, one of the women was sexually assaulted, as well as brutalized by these physicals. That young woman today is known as the feminist Andrea Dworkin, but at that time, nobody knew who she was. She was just a young peace activist. When she got out of the prison, nobody wanted to talk to her. Her parents were ashamed. She kind of stumbled around their house before she finally left after like 2 days and didn't know what to do. And then she remembered that she'd left these clothes with this other woman. And so she went to her apartment, and that woman was the writer and activist Grace Paley. And Grace Paley saw what had happened to her, and she got her a doctor. and the doctor told her how badly she had been harmed internally. And then Grace Paley contacted every journalist she knew and every writer and made sure that Andrea Dworkin's story hit every newspaper in New York and then every newspaper in the country. Andrea Dworkin was in front of the radio, in front of newspaper journalists, on television. She was young. She was not yet an out queer woman. She sort of demonized some of the lesbianism that was in the prison. It was a very complicated thing, what she had to say. But because of who she was, because she was white and young and feminine and a college student, and she had this network of activists and writers and other college students behind her, the prisons couldn't dismiss her claims the way they did everyone else's. And within about 2 weeks of her coming forward and Grace Paley helping her publicize her story, five separate government commissions opened up to investigate what was happening in the House of D. They did almost nothing. In fact, it really just became kind of a pummeling point in the mayoral race. And in the long run, however, it determined the end of the House of D because they really didn't want to have this kind of public embarrassment anymore. And so they wanted to shut down the prison in Greenwich Village where it was easily seen and people could hear what was happening and move everything to Rikers Island. So after her arrest, there had been a plan in the works for about a decade to move the prison to Rikers Island, and it kept getting put off because they didn't have the money and they didn't have the want to build a new institution. But once this really harsh spotlight was shown on the institution, that plan became inevitable, and within 6 years, everyone has moved out.
Where exactly was the House of D, and what is there now?
If you're familiar with Greenwich Village at all, it's the intersection of 6th Avenue, Greenwich Street, Christopher Street, and 10th Street. It's like a little star shape. There's a library there now, actually, called the Jefferson Market Library. It's a beautiful building. It's this red brick, late 1800s, big clock tower, stained glass windows, circular staircases. If you listen to the Mamas and the Papas, there's a song where they sing about how, with a clock that always says 12:30, they're talking about that prison. That was the women's court that I talked about and was turned into the library. And the garden that's next to it was the prison itself. But they tore that whole institution down in 1974. So for many years, I would go and sit in this garden and do interviews as a journalist on my cell phone and thought what this beautiful oasis, you know, this was and how wonderful it was that the village had given this gift to the city. And now I can't go there because it is such an awful place and there is absolutely no recognition of what happened to the women and trans men who passed through the prison. There's this tiny little plaque there and it's really shitty. It like talks about the incarcerated people only as like a plague on the true residents, you know, that they caused a lot of noise and commotion, and so it was just really better once they were moved out and then we had this beautiful garden. So yeah, it's really sad. I can't go there anymore. But if you want to check it out, it's really beautiful.
So the prison has moved to Rikers Island, and is it still active? Is it still a woman's prison?
Yeah, so in the move to Rikers Island, they opened up a prison. I can never remember the name of the first one. It's like the ICCS or something like that. It was supposed to be bigger and better than the House of D. It was going to have this huge nursery and all this stuff, much like the House of D. By the time it opens, all the best parts, like the hospital, have been scrapped to make room for more cages. It was supposed to, the House of D could hold 400 people. By the time it was closed, it had about 800 people in it at a time, so twice the number of people it was meant to hold. The new institution was supposed to hold 800 people. By the time it closed, it had about 1,500 people in it, 500 of whom were male adolescents because they had nowhere to put the number of young boys that were being incarcerated in the 1970s because of the escalating war on drugs, which is really a war on the black community in New York. And so they tore that place down, and they opened up Rosie's, the Rose M. Singer Correctional Facility, which has been active ever since. Rosie's is just as much of a hellhole as the House of D ever was, and they're working right now to close Rosie's and to close Rikers in general and to actually undo kind of what they did in moving the institution to the island, instead having these borough-based jails that will be in the local areas where incarcerated people are to sort of start to do some of that work to reintroduce these folks into the community and to stop sort of imagining incarceration as something that we do to other people far away. Now there's this new push. I read a little bit about it, and it made me roll my eyes so hard I couldn't. But this new like idea of a feminist jail that maybe they're going to open on Rikers instead, like a kinder, softer women's institution with pink bars. I don't know. It sounds like a terrible idea, but it's still there. Yeah, I'm still on Rikers.
I think that's about it for all the questions that we have.
Yeah, I want to say thank you so much for doing this, and thank you to all of you for coming out like in the middle of a pandemic when the weather is actually nice. Like, that's a lot to ask on a Thursday night in Pride. So thank you, everyone. And thank you to the library for hosting this amazing event in this beautiful space.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.